and August at historic sites and museums across the state. Details at secondsaturdaysnc.com. This is WFAE News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, proud sponsor of StoryCorps, celebrating the power of listening.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For all of the positives about North Carolina, there is one aspect of the state that is alarming. Some say it's shameful. Our rising poverty rate. The state has gone from being ranked 26th in the nation to 12th. More than 1.7 million North Carolinians are living in poverty today, right now. And the question is, why? Perhaps the even more important question is, what, if anything, can be done about it? Fannie Flono, the Charlotte Observer's associate editor, recently wrote a column calling for the forging of a comprehensive poverty plan. She joins us this hour in our studio. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
Good to see you.
Good to be here.
We've also invited Reverend Mac Ledgerton to be with us. He is the executive director of the Center for Community Action. That's a multicultural, community-based nonprofit in Lumberton, specializing in grassroots empowerment as a foundation for social change. He joins us by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us from the studios of WUNC in Chapel Hill is Jean Nickel, director of the UNC Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity. That's an effort of the university and its School of Law. Mr. Nickel also writes a monthly column on poverty called Seeing the Invisible for the Raleigh News and Observer. Will those columns also appear in the Charlotte Observer, or do you know, Jean?
I think some, perhaps, are going
right.
to. A little later, the... We're going to turn specifically to Mecklenburg County, and so I think that's likely.
Well, welcome to all three of you. In North Carolina, as I said, we've gone from 26th in the nation to 12th in the nation in the terms of the number of people living in poverty. Over what period of time did this ranking change? I'm not sure who to ask that question of. I'm looking at you, Fannie, so I'll ask you, and if you don't know the answer, we'll pass it on to somebody else.
You know, I don't know exactly, but I think it's been probably over the last... decade. Would that be
that's
in
right,
the ballpark?
In the last decade, we've not only increased poverty levels fairly dramatically, which would not be a great surprise to anyone given the depth of the recession, but we've also increased poverty levels relative to our other states. So as the numbers indicated, a decade ago, we were 26, which means, you know, it's
12th,
not great, but
12th,
we were
12th.
No, no. A decade ago, we were 26.
Oh, okay.
In our poverty level, which
meant
we were
me,
a little better than average. In the succeeding decade, we have moved to 12th. So we're speeding past other states in terms of the level of poverty in North Carolina, which is even more alarming, I think, than the general number.
Yeah, I got confused there because being number one in this case is not a good thing. I got confused. Is it just that we were hit pretty hard by the recession, more so than some other states, and we've been slow to come out of the recession? Is the recession what is to blame for this, or is it policy that's to blame for this in addition to the recession? What's going on here?
Well, Mac, I imagine you would talk a little bit about the policies because that's some of the things that you've talked to me about in terms of what has happened in North Carolina. You know, one of the things that really alarmed me was the number of children who are now in poverty and the fact that North Carolina has kind of flipped on who are the most people who are in poverty. It used to be elderly people. Back in the 60s, when Terry Sanford was coming up with his poverty plan, it used to be the elderly. And we've done some great things to help the elderly become stabilized and not fall below the poverty line as much as they used to. But instead, we've kind of neglected or at least not forged policies well enough to address the poverty among children.
Yeah, in your recent column, when you talk about the 1.7 million people in North Carolina living in poverty, which, by the way, is more than the population of New Hampshire.
And that was an astonishing fact.
Of those, most of them, are half of them, are children. 25% of all children in North Carolina live in poverty. 40% of minority children live in poverty. Do you think that most North Carolinians know this, or that most legislators understand this?
Mike?
Yes.
This is Mac. I think the major rise in poverty has happened since the early 90s, which is directly related to the federal free trade agreements and particularly its impact on rural states such as North Carolina with what we call NAFTA, mm-hmm. the North American Free Trade Agreement, because that really opened up the gates for our jobs to go overseas, particularly in the area of manufacturing, furniture, and agriculture, and particularly the tobacco industry. So we've lost major sectors of our economy, as a result of the international agreements. And that's really the number one policy that has caused okay. So many people through no fault of their own to move into the pretty severe poverty ranks.
And is
Mike,
that...
if I could add, you raised the question, do normal people and do our legislative mm-hmm. leaders and our government officials know this alarming state of poverty? And the answer to that is either no, or they don't know about it, or they do know about it and they've chosen to ignore it. You want to add some perspective to this. We not only have 40% of our children of color living in poverty, but this is the richest nation on earth, the richest nation in human history. We have much higher child poverty levels than any other advanced Western democracy. We have much, much larger gaps between rich and poor than any other advanced Western democracy, or essentially any other nation. Our colleagues, our running buddies in terms of inequality, are places like Uganda and Madagascar. They're not any advanced nations that we would normally recognize. So we are boldly out of step in how we treat poor people, the levels of poverty that we allow. A lot of folks have tried to bring this to the attention of our public officials. I know we did a large poverty tour across North Carolina with the NAACP last year. Mac participated in that. But as a result of it, we tried to get the gubernatorial candidates in the election to discuss their plans concerning poverty, recognizing that they would be different. But if we have this alarming poverty rate, growing poverty rate relative to our peers, you would think that this would at least be a public issue. Neither gubernatorial candidate would address it. We asked the folks who were, Reverend Barber and I asked the folks who were moderating the debates to raise questions on it. They wouldn't do that. So this is North Carolina's largest problem, but it is largely missing from our discourse.
I want to come back to several of the things you talked about in a second, but let's talk about governors for a moment. You just talked about Walter Dalton, who was the Democratic candidate for governor in the last election, and of course Pat McCrory, who won the race, the Republican governor, now from Charlotte. And Fannie, you pointed out in your recent column another governor, Terry Sanford, and you mentioned him earlier this morning, and his North Carolina Fund, which he initiated in 1963. It inspired President Johnson's war on poverty and helped the state make significant progress from a time when 37% of the state's residents had incomes below the federal poverty level. What has changed at the gubernatorial level, at the state level, that something like that would be, which was relatively visionary and groundbreaking, and we've moved to where we are today? How did we go from one end of the fulcrum to the other?
Well, I think we just kind of lost sight of the vision, the vision, the goal, for one thing. You must remember, though, when the North Carolina Fund was set in place in 1963, I believe. It only lasted for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was probably the extent of the length of what it was supposed to last. But there were some lasting initiatives that came out of that. Manpower Development Corporation was one of those things that came out of that. Dressing young children and preschool and that sort of thing, that came out of that kind of movement, too. And it was all part of the national mm-hmm. movement, too, to help deal with poverty issues. And so that was an initiative that was not just about government doing things. In fact, it was more about partnering with private groups and grassroots strategies to deal with these issues. And so it was kind of a comprehensive way of dealing with it. And the same kind of thing that Mac Ledgerton talks about now that right. they're doing in Robeson County. And it's the kind of thing that you need to kind of think about doing across the state. So I think we kind of lost sight of what we really wanted to do. I think other issues kind of intervened. Of course, you know, this was right in the time of all kind of racial issues that were happening in the state. And so some of the attention, I would say, got diverted, maybe not, because these issues are related, obviously. Race and class are related issues. But I think that we were dealing with them as separate issues in many ways, and we should have always been dealing with them as kind of a complete kind of a, you know, partnering of issues.
Both of you, Gene.
I think you could add that Terry Sanford famously said, "We didn't lose the war on poverty, we abandoned the field." So
wow.
I'm not sure that doesn't sum it up pretty well.
Yeah.
Gene, both you and Mac have worked directly with people in poverty for some time now, and you are working on this year-long series of newspaper columns. And to write that column, you have traveled to some of the state's poorest areas, and you say that what you witnessed stunned you and demeaned you. And I'd like to hear from both you and Mac about what poverty in North Carolina looks like.
Well, of course, the answer to that is a long answer. But let me just say quickly, I come from a university, and universities are famed for doing studies and reports and the like, and I'm not completely opposed to that. But this poverty tour, which we did with a strong sort of leadership of Reverend Barber, was rooted in the notion that the numbers alone, you know, whether you're talking about a poverty rate of 12% or 18% or 22%, they don't capture the notion of poverty. So we wanted to try and take journalists and funders and legislators and activists and ministers and students with us to see some parts of North Carolina face to face that would perhaps surprise them. We could give you a long litany of what surprised us. I mean, starting with, you know, the sort of picturesque town of Elizabeth City, where there are 26 beds for homeless folks and over 400 homeless women and men, and yet the city wouldn't cooperate sort of with building additional shelter space. There are folks waiting out, camping out all night long in Halifax County, waiting to get the early spot in the line for the food bank. People who had never used food banks before, food pantries before, but who are worried, of course, in the richest nation on earth, that if they don't get that early spot in the line, that they won't be able to feed their children. Camping out all night long in midwinter. It is a long litany of things that would shock most North Carolinians and which mock our commitment to equal dignity and justice and equal protection under law.
Let me stop you there. Let me stop you there. I have to take a break. We'll come back and let you finish, and I want to hear from Mac on this issue as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Garage Door Guru, providing local, comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com. Well, Charlotte is among the finalists to host the X Games in 2014 through 2016. These are ESPN games. These are like the we want to be an Olympic city. And if you're going to be an Olympic city, you have to get the X Games first. But to get the X Games, you have to have a skateboard park, because skateboarding is one of the games in the X Games. Well, Charlotte doesn't have a skateboard park, and skateboarders, whether or not we get the X Games, want one, and they have a proposal to put one at Bryant Park. We're going to talk about the sport, about the possibility of a dedicated facility, and the possibility of the X Games tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the city of Detroit and its $20 billion debt. What's ahead for residents, unions, and investors, and the implications for other cash-strapped U.S. cities.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Fanny Flon is in our studio. She is the associate editor of the Charlotte Observer, who wrote about poverty in North Carolina in a recent column. Along with us, joining us from the studios of WUNC in Chapel Hill, Gene Nickel, director of the UNC Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity. And Mac Ledgerton is joining us by phone. He's the executive director of the Center for Community Action. I want to come back to you, Gene, in just a couple of seconds. But I want to get Mac Ledgerton into this conversation to give us his take on what poverty in North Carolina looks like. Because if we have 25% of all children in the state living in poverty, and 40% of all minority children in the state living in poverty, and if the number of people living in poverty in North Carolina is bigger than the population of New Hampshire, that's amazing. How can they be so invisible? How can we not recognize it? What does it look like? Mac.
Well, it looks like a lot of people who are out of work, and then a lot of people in families who are working, but their wages are very low. A lot of our service economy that is growing but replaced the manufacturing jobs, you know, the wages are very low, and people are still eligible for public assistance if they would like to have that support for food and other assistance, even though they're working full time. So it looks like the unemployed, it looks like the underemployed, and it looks like a lot of children and a lot of elderly, as well as the unemployable or the people that are truly disabled, and it really looks like people who really want to do better. Yes, there are those who have really given up, but most low-income people really want to do better, and in decades past have done better through their will and their commitment to, you know, for their own livelihood and that of their family.
How many of these people would you say are in this situation because it's generational? Their parents were poor. Their parents' parents were poor. They did not get an education. And versus how many people are in this situation because of circumstances well beyond their control, and they're in a situation that they never in their wildest dreams thought they would find themselves in?
Well, I think it's true for both, and you know, the generational poverty, we model ourselves mostly after our parents and other family members. And so if your parents did not go beyond high school in their education, then the chances are that you won't as well. Mm-hmm. So the causes of poverty and wealth are not that different. Most people are poor because they're born into it, and also because they have a low educational level. And most folks who are wealthier or middle income were born into that level of income and achieved a higher level of educational.
Would it be accurate to say that those in the middle, if you're born into wealth and you're born into poverty, that those in the middle, it's difficult to move up and it's easy to move down?
Particularly in the present economy, and I think most people feel that. My are solutions to poverty that really work, and our communities can learn about those and work together to really make a significant impact on poverty when our public and private agencies and businesses come together out of a deep commitment to solve it. But we've really got to get beyond the division between those who think that it's the responsibility of individuals and those who think that it's the responsibility of our systems. And both are correct. And so our work on poverty needs to really focus on the individual level as well as on the systems level.
Gene Nickel, you started your year-long series of columns on poverty in the News and Observer with two really powerful opening paragraphs. You quote, the Declaration of Independence's mention that all men are created equal, the echo of that in Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, and our Constitution guaranteeing equal protection under the law, and how we all proudly pledge allegiance to the flag of one nation with liberty and justice for all. But you go on to say, that's talking a good game, and what we do is something altogether different. You write, the statistics of American poverty are straightforward and astonishing. The richest nation on earth, over 15% of us, fall below the stingy poverty standard of $23,000 a year for a family of four. We have more poor people in poverty in raw numbers than at any moment in our history, more on a percentage basis than at any time in a quarter century. How do you explain the disconnect between what we profess to be and what we are?
Well, let me say first that I agree with what you just
You wrote it.
Read. That sounds right to me. And it's part of the, I think, the great dilemma of American economic inequality. I think it's fair to say this. There are three facts in my judgment that sort of move at the vortex of American poverty, which are undeniable. That is, first, this is the richest nation on earth, you know, the richest nation in human history. Secondly, we have higher levels of poverty than any other advanced nation. And then third, Americans believe universally that this is the fairest, most egalitarian, most profoundly committed nation to liberty and justice for all that ever populated the planet. Now, I come from a university, and sort of facile folks can square a lot of things, but you can't square those three notions. You cannot be the richest, the poorest, and the fairest all at once. We do it. How do we accomplish that? I think in there's probably a lot of components to our strategy, but principally we accomplish it by what my old friend Paul Wellstone would say is turning our gaze away from those locked at the bottom. You would be familiar with this in Charlotte. You know, look around you and you see all kinds mm-hmm. of folks who are doing quite well. My kids are doing well. Your kids are doing well. Their friends' kids are doing well. There may be some economic challenges, but they're on the other side of the county or the other side of the tracks or on the other side of the, for us, sometimes the other side of the state. And we simply turn our gaze away from them, and we look at more congenial quarters. That allows us to merrily go ahead believing this is not only the richest but the fairest of countries when the facts are powerfully contrary.
Well, we also have this tradition of thinking of ourselves as individuals who pick ourselves up by our bootstraps and make the best of a bad situation and move on. That if so-and-so can make it, so can you. Is that getting in our way? Is that true? If so-and-so can make it, so can you. Is that true?
First of all, it's not true in a very powerful way. That is, we have now become among the least economically mobile of advanced nations. So that sort of consistent with the discussion before, if you're born poor in the United States, you are more apt to stay poor than in other countries. If you're born wealthy, you're more apt to stay that way than in other countries. So broadly speaking, our roadmap, our track record is not good. what we do, in my view, I say we overlearn the lesson of Abraham Lincoln or Barack Obama. That is, it's part of the American psyche very dramatically that Abraham Lincoln begins in a log cabin and works his way up to be president of the United States. Now we would say that about President Obama, too. Therefore, the conclusion goes, if you try hard, you can make it. And therefore, we have no obligation. We have no public responsibility, which is triggered by the fact that we're the richest nation on earth. We talk the most about equality, and we do less to bring it about than other nations. I think, in my view, we overlearn the lesson of Abraham Lincoln and refuse to look at our facts.
You call poverty a willful marginalization and infliction of demeaning indignity. That sounds like we do this to people deliberately. Explain that.
Well, it seems to me it's a part of what's important to understand is this is a choice. These are not natural occurrences. We don't. It's not just happenstance that in the United States we treat poor people less favorably than other nations do. That's a choice that we have made or a choice that we've had thrust upon us. We make decisions about how we're going to treat wealthy people, how we're going to treat poor people all the time. We don't tend to think of it that way, but let me just give you a couple. How would you explain to James Madison, a nation which decides to tax its wealthiest people, its corporate capital gains folks, at a rate half or less than it taxes everybody else, so that those who work for a living are made to pay twice as high a tax rate as those who live off of speculation. I don't know how you would explain that choice to sort of sensible people sitting around
there,
in the room.
In fairness, there are a lot of people who work for a living with 401ks who take advantage, and not even 401ks, just regular investment accounts that are happy to get that 15% capital gains tax rate as opposed to whatever the 35% might be if it was regular income.
And I'm sure that the wealthiest people in the United States are very happy to get that 15% too. I just don't know how you explain to the secretary of the hedge fund operator that he or she has to pay over twice the rate that the person who's making billions of dollars. How do you explain that in good conscience? It can't be done.
Capitalism.
We have, that's not capitalism. It's not capitalism to say that the very richest people are going to be taxed at half the rate of people who work for a living. What has that got to do with capitalism? That's simply wealthy people purchasing the political system and getting the payoff from it. You say this too. We have a very expensive and aggressive housing program in the United States. It's called the mortgage deduction. It cost us over $100 billion a year, and it's meant to subsidize housing. Sadly, 85% of the benefits go to people making over $100,000 a year. Now, that's a choice. How would you explain to the world that we're going to have an intervention in the market, we're going to have a federal housing program, it's just going to go principally to wealthy people? I think we make choices like that every day. These are not natural givens. They're not the handed down from God Almighty. We have chosen to favor wealthy people far more dramatically than other nations have.
But there are a lot of people who are living in homes that are less than $110,000 who are taking advantage of the mortgage deduction. They're not wealthy people.
85% of the benefits from the mortgage deduction go to people making over $100,000 a year. Now, I think if you were to decide to have a program which was going to subsidize housing, you would direct it at folks at the bottom. It seems to me, sensibly, we direct ours to those at the top, and we say that's simply the natural order of things, or that's capitalism. It's not capitalism. That's government policies which help wealthy people and which poorer people cannot take advantage of.
Mac, there are people who are listening to this program who would say that there have always been poor people in the world and there always will be poor people in the world. And what do you say to people who say that and who also point out that there is in this country free education offered to every child from kindergarten through the 12th grade? And if you do well there, you can probably get a scholarship to college. And yet many people don't graduate high school because they simply don't they don't graduate. They don't pay attention in class. They don't come to school. They become educational failures. And part of that is because of our system, and maybe, but part of it has to be on the individual. How would you respond to people who say that?
Well, I think we really need to look at the responsibilities that do lie with individuals, with families, with communities, those three. And then we also need to look at the responsibilities that that are based in our institutions, our systems, and our cultures. So to me, there's those six levels, and then we also have a seventh level, the moral and spiritual level of responsibility. So I think there's, you know, at least these, and then the environmental level, the environment we live in. So there's these eight levels, and, you know, to really address poverty, we have to address all those levels. We just can't focus on the individual and community and family level. Mm-hmm. We just can't focus on the institutional and systems and cultural level, or the environmental level, or the moral and spiritual level. So, and I think that's where the problem lies, is that we're just not looking at the situation comprehensively enough to make a significant gain in lowering poverty. And I think that's where we have the lack of will. We have an understanding now that we need to do that, but we seem to have a lack of will, and we really have to turn this issue back over to our communities and get them engaged. And there's some exciting things happening in North Carolina to help do that.
Go ahead, Fanny. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to interject because one of the things that I was really enlightened about as I traveled across the state and looked at some of these places and talked to Mac and other people about some of the challenges that poor people face in lifting themselves up. Mm-hmm. Is that you really don't have a good sense until you live in the situations in which some of these people live about all of the different kinds of obstacles that are in their path to success. For instance, if you are a child who got into college on a scholarship or got some aid, not enough that you don't have to work, you got to work and go to school at the same time. Mm-hmm. And you are often helping support your family at the same time that you are going to work because, you know, they need money from you to do that. Your car breaks down. You don't have the money to actually fix the car. So you try to find a way to get to where you need to be. The other thing is, too, in rural areas, there's really no public transportation, which I was not really fully cognizant of. I mean, you get so used to it in big cities like Charlotte that you think, you know, people who don't have a car have a way to get to a job, get to school. These people have to find ways to do these things. And if they don't get some kind of supports, encouragement even, to say, you can do this, you can find a way, I can help you find, you know, a path to actually connect the dots so that you can actually, you know, get to school, get your car fixed and all that stuff, it's really hard.
Fanny Flono is associate editor of the Charlotte Observer. On the line with us is Mac Ledgerton, executive director of the Center for Community Action. And joining us from WUNC in Chapel Hill is Gene Nickel, director of the UNC Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity. We're taking a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Crown Clinic, celebrating 10 years of serving Charlotte area families. Full in-house services in internal medicine, urgent care, and minor trauma. Accepting new patients. Details at crownclinicpa.com. The city of Detroit and its $20 billion debt. What's ahead for residents, unions, and investors, plus implications for other cash-strapped U.S. cities. That's the topic of the conversation, 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to continue our conversation about poverty as we go forward to the end of the hour. And if you'd like to join us, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks gives you every electronic way possible, except possibly by phone, 704-926-WFAE. We're coming right back.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tapper Brothers.
Thinking about a new car with all the latest technology?
You bet I am.
Like ABS and GPS?
I was thinking of, like, doors and windows.
Well, if you're getting rid of a car that's still in good shape, donate it and get a tax break. Call 1-866-789-TMCP.
TMCP?
Take my car, please.
That's 866-789-8627.
Or go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHA. I'm Mike Collins with Fannie Flono, Mac Ledgerton, and Gene Nickel. And we're talking about poverty in North Carolina. In case you're just joining us, let me give out these numbers again, because these are fairly alarming numbers. 1.7 million people in North Carolina live in poverty. They live below the federal poverty level, which is $23,550 a year for a family of four. And in fact, there may actually be more people living in poverty, because that's evidently a miserable way to account for poverty that was set in the 1960s, 1965, and even with being adjusted for inflation, it doesn't count, take into account the fact that food used to take up a lot more of a person's budget than it does today. Housing takes up more of a person's budget than it does today, and we've done many programs on the shortage of affordable housing in this area, and that's a problem throughout the state. So 1.7 million people live in poverty. 25% of all children live in poverty in North Carolina. 40% of all children, minority children, live in poverty. And we have a comment from the web that says, with the Republican politicians lowering corporate and income taxes for the rich, lowering unemployment benefits, cutting funds for education, what do we expect to see? The lack of social concern is deplorable. Some states have even mandated higher minimum wages within the state. The state is not concerned about the economic climate unless it is the health of the wealthiest contributors to political campaigns, something that probably, Gene, you would echo in some form there. There are 100 areas of concentrated poverty in North Carolina. Where are they?
They are, well, there are two answers to that, which I think are instructive maybe for this program. A lot of them are in what we have thought of historically as persistent poverty counties in North Carolina. There's a federal standard which says that if you've had a certain extraordinarily high level of poverty for over 30 years, you are regarded as a persistent poverty county. That's the sort of generational poverty that you've been discussing. And we have 10 of those counties. They are dominantly in eastern North Carolina. But you also ask, where are the poorest sections of North Carolina? We accurately say that we describe our poverty sort of in this way. We have chronic persistent rural poverty in North Carolina, and we have these great bustling metropolises, which are powerful economic engines, so it's a sort of rural-urban phenomenon. Surprisingly, I've talked with Fannie about this, and I know she's written some about it, much of the deepest poverty in North Carolina, the sort of most intense poverty, these poverty levels where people live at less than half of the federal poverty standard, are located right in the middle of Charlotte, right in the middle of Raleigh, right in the middle of Durham, right in the middle of Greensboro, right in the middle of Winston-Salem. We have a very deep urban poverty, which, because we usually look at poverty on countywide or citywide bases, the average notion, it sort of masks. So we have very deep urban poverty, though we usually don't talk about it very much. We're far more used to talking about rural poverty in North Carolina.
Fannie, bring it home. Mecklenburg County.
Well, you know, what I think that there's a statistic that says, you know, over the last maybe 10 years or maybe even less, that the poverty rate has gone up, I think, 53% in Mecklenburg County. And the the number of people who have the population has increased by only 18%. I mean, you look at those figures and you can clearly see that there is a problem right here among us. And, you know, you talk about the invisibility of poverty to a lot of people. And I think that happens more often in places like Mecklenburg County, where you do have such a great wealth and you kind of walk around and you see all these great shiny buildings and everything. And you don't get off the beaten path very much to see the kind of poverty that exists among us. You know, I got a chance to see it in various ways. I was once a volunteer helping with a woman who was dealing with a battered women's shelter. And I would deliver toys to kids who were in these areas that were really poor. And they're kind of off the beaten path. They are kind of hidden. Mm-hmm. You don't really see it. And then you go into these places and you are astounded that you are in Mecklenburg County. So it's sad. And I think it's something that as a community, as a state, we need to put some effort into dealing with. You know, one of the things, one of the reasons why I wanted to do this series, and I've been wanting to do it before the Republicans got into power, because this has been an ongoing problem. I think there are some policies that really do hurt right now for the people kind of getting up, trying to get out of poverty. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the reasons that I wanted to do this is to kind of open people's eyes to what is all around them. And to kind of nudge people to do something. I mean, because the kids, I mean, I think there is among some people this notion that people are poor because they don't work hard enough, or, you know, they don't, you know, that they're lazy.
Or that they know they'll get a government check.
Or they know they will get a government check. And I think, like Mac said, and I talked to a lot of people, especially when I was at the food pantry, about how they are living. There's one woman that I quoted who talked about how she worked 7 days a week, and she found out she had cancer, and now she can't work, but I mean, she had two jobs. I mean, they are working very hard.
In fact, yesterday on this program, John Connaughton, who's an economist with UNC Charlotte and the keeper of the economic forecast, the official state forecast for the economy, said that one of the reasons that the legislature decided to cut off benefits, in addition to the fact that it was deficit spending and that we had to pay that money back to the federal government, and it had already reached in excess of $1 billion, was the fact that at $400 a week for unemployment, that becomes a benchmark against which – and he had a term for this, which I've now forgotten – but it was a benchmark against which people will say, I'm getting $400, so I can't go to work unless I get $500. And isn't there some truth to that?
Well, you know, I heard your program yesterday, and I don't know whether that's true, but most people don't get that $400. I mean, that's at the top end. I mean, that's where
people can't live on that anyway.
Well, and that's for people who've been making a lot more money.
Right.
So, I mean, most people who are getting unemployment, who are, you know, who you would think would be the people who would be lazing around and wanting a check, they're not getting $400. They're getting something considerably less than that.
Okay.
And if they're, you know, if they're raising a family, that's just not going to cut it.
I want to bring Mark in Weddington into this program. He's been holding on for a long time. He has a very interesting question. Mark, go ahead.
Yes. Great program. I go to St. Matthew's Church, and we're in the middle of a food drive in for Haiti. And last week, our pastor came in and told us that the churches in Charlotte have been communicating together, explaining that because of sequester and other problems, that there is a huge groundswell of need for food and other items in our own state, in our own cities, in our own community, which was a total shock, you know, that there's not even enough food in our pantries these days to cover the needs of these people.
And your question was?
My question is, where are the churches at this point? Where are church leaders? Why aren't they coming forward? This is a human rights issue. We are supposed to be a Christian state. our legislators are spend all day long trying to figure out ways of cutting funding for the poor so that they can give tax cuts to the wealthy. Where is the justice here?
Okay, let me stop you there because you've made your point. Thank you, Mark, for your question. And Mac, you're in addition to being the executive director for the Center for Community Action, you're also a reverend. Several years ago, it began with Ronald Reagan, perhaps George H.W. Bush, who mentioned his 1,000 points of light. They wanted the faith community to come in and do what had been shouldered by the government, help people out of poverty, help people who are in poverty to exist. Can the faith community do it on their own? And how are they responding to the current crisis?
Well, many, many churches are very active in poverty services and ministries. The challenge is that we've had such a large growth in poverty over a very short period of time, and it just looks like it's going to continue to grow in North Carolina and the nation. So, but I think the challenge is that, you know, our churches are very assimilated into our culture, and even in our churches, it's a challenge. You know, we now require our ministers to be a pastor, a priest, and a prophet. And in the days of the Old and New Testament, the Hebrew and Christian testaments, the prophet and the priest were never the same person. So institutionally, we have put roles that clearly conflict with each other into, you know, the manifestation of one person in our clergy.
Can the faith community take up the slack now that the government is cutting the programs? We began to cut these programs years ago. It's not recent, but it's continuing. Can the faith community, can churches, can synagogues, can temples, can
the answer is we all can do more. And from the faith perspective, you know, it's from all of our traditions, it's the least of these which is our main concern and model of God's presence in our lives and in our communities. But, you know, in a democracy, the inclusive link is our commitment to the common good. And in economic times of economic insecurity, it's really easy for people's hearts to get hardened and for people to, you know, just blame the victims. Mm-hmm. And no, the churches cannot manage the rise in poverty. We've got to bring our churches, our public sector, and our private business sector together, because poverty hurts everyone, and it even hurts our businesses. I mean, we can't, you know, people can't purchase and contribute economically to other people's well-being when they don't have resources.
And it costs us more in law enforcement as well.
Every aspect.
Last month, the Charlotte Observer printed a series of actions by the legislature that have hurt the poor, eliminating the earned income tax credit, reducing eligibility for pre-K, giving up federal jobless benefits, and the rejection of the Medicaid expansion. So let's take those one by one as quickly as we can because we're running out of time here. Lawmakers signed off on a bill to cut the earned income tax credit to 4.5% of the federal credit in 2013 and to get rid of it altogether thereafter. Has the governor signed the bill, Fannie?
No. Isn't that in the budget bill? I think.
I think he's indicated that he will.
Okay.
That's coming. And what you'd want to add for perspective on that is that we have a legislature that claims to be immensely averse to raising taxes, but there's an exception to that. Working families, you know, maybe a family of four making $35,000 a year. Now, as a result of abolishing the state's earned income tax credit, they're going to have to pay more. They're going to have to pay more so that we can offset the decision also being made to do away with the estate tax. So you can sort of weigh 900,000 North Carolinians who will pay more against a handful, I don't know, 25 families or whatever, who will not have to pay an estate tax. But the truth of it is the bulk of this legislature and the governor don't seem to consider those 900,000 families part of their constituency.
We gave up the jobless benefits. We've cut the jobless benefits because that money has to be paid back to the federal government. Is there another side to that argument? We're trying to cut deficit spending here and be fiscally responsible. What's the other side of that argument?
Well, it seems one other side of that argument is we have chosen to turn away huge amounts of money already allocated to North Carolina by the federal government because we wanted to change our program. The chairwoman who announced the changes said, well, she knows it's going to mean that, 170,000 families are going to lose benefits already paid for by the federal government, not a cost of a dime to us. But it's too much trouble to go back and fix things. The truth of it is we have a legislature right now that is waging war on poor people in North Carolina.
Under the Affordable Care Act, which is scheduled at least to go into effect in January, we've turned down the money offered by the federal government for Medicaid expansion. Would we have had to pay that money back? And if not, why would we turn it down?
No, we wouldn't have to pay
ideological
it back.
Ideological reasons.
The federal government pays all of the tab for 3 years, and then I think 98% of the tab. But we could have accepted just the 3 years, like some states have done. But the truth is, we wanted to prove ideologically that we are tougher than other states. We're trying very hard to show that we can be as we can replicate Mississippi and North Carolina and make them proud.
And, Mac, you alluded to some success stories, and I only have 40 seconds, and I'm sorry about that. But what's the most successful program that you know about in the state for helping people?
Well, yeah, I think that's the problem with this. The challenge is we spend so much time ventilating about the issue, we don't get to the solutions. And I think communities really need to come together and build support systems to help the poor move out of poverty because that is their will and interest. And helping people move into careers.